This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and top leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve LeBall.
And welcome to another edition of Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau, your host, and I'd like to thank Sarah Moe for filling in for my long stretch of absence when I was recovering from a stroke. And I'm back here with my first guest. We have just one guest today, a very special guest, Maria Jetty, the soprano. Do I need to say more?
I think I would just say a soprano rather than the soprano.
Well,
and currently I just say a vocalist.
In my book, you're the soprano. And we've known each other for a long time.
Yes, we met well in the last century.
I think we were teenagers.
I must have been.
In the previous century. And our paths have crossed once and again, but I don't think I've ever sat down one-on-one and just interviewed you for an hour.
I think you're quite right about that.
So this is a wonderful opportunity. Great to be back in the chair here with the microphones at WCCO. So Maria, now, I've seen you sing, and just a wonderful, beautiful voice. You've had a kind of a varied career, but how did you find out you were a singer? Were you like in kindergarten? They had like a star search, and Ed McMahon found you, or what?
Sadly, no.
No.
Or actually, probably fortunately, no. No, I was just always a kid who kind of liked to sing, but I didn't run around singing or anything like that. I mean, I sang in church with the family, and we were a Catholic family. So people who sang audibly in the Catholic Church, at that point at least, were looked upon with shock and horror, as I recall, because few people seemed to sing audibly in the Catholic Church, at least in those days. So.
Well, I mean, especially if you're from Minnesota, you don't want to sing out loud.
That's right. So there was a lot of staring at the hymnal. But that was the one thing I did like about church, was the singing part, and we sang. And in school, you know, in those days in the 60s, I think there wasn't a lot of music education in the various schools that I attended in the United States. And then we lived overseas for a few years.
Where?
Karachi, Pakistan, and Johannesburg, South Africa.
Gosh. Mm-hmm. How was that?
Incredible. I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, why did you live in those places? Your father was...
Yeah, I just went along with my father since I was 7 years old.
Well, what was he doing?
He worked for Eli Lilly Pharmaceuticals.
Oh, okay.
And they, you know, it's a gigantic multinational corporation. And they had a tiny little outpost in Karachi, of which I think my father was the sole representative.
Okay.
So he was their training sales.
The honcho. So what was it like to go to school in Karachi? Was it like one of these... international schools where they speak English?
Yeah, it was Karachi American School.
Oh, wow.
And it still exists in a certain form. And I've actually contacted a couple of my old classmates via Facebook.
Wow. You know,
Karachi American School Group.
What grades were you there?
Second through fourth.
Oh, well, those are the formative years.
They certainly are.
Gosh.
Or were.
Well.
Yeah, made me what I am today.
Well.
In some respects.
That's good. Did you learn any Karachi?
Afrikaans. Urdu. Afrikaans was in South Africa.
Okay.
Well, all I could ever say was salam alaikum, alaikum salam. And I was able to write my name in Urdu or Arabic.
Oh.
At least I think it's my name.
So what does salam mean?
It just means hello and God be with you. The alaikum part. I mean, you've heard versions of that.
Sure.
Because depending on the country that the Muslim greeting is coming from, it's just pronounced a little bit differently and spelled differently.
So did you have a chance to interact with the regular Pakistanis, or were you segregated onto like a little American island?
Well, in a way, segregated in an American island, yes. But in another way, no, in that all the Americans who lived there in the 60s had a whole passel of servants. So we had a cook who was sort of the major domo of the house. And he was from Bangladesh, which in those days was still called East Pakistan.
Right.
And he was fantastic. I mean, really interesting person, at least interesting to me at my age. And he was a former hotel chef. So he cooked very fancily for our family.
Wow.
You know, we had potatoes, mashed potatoes that were piped into beautiful designs. So, I mean, to me, it was pure luxury and fun.
Did you have curry?
Very rarely. We had pretty much American-style food in our home.
Wow.
But there was also a nanny called the Aya. And there was a guy who drove the car, the chauffeur, and the chowkidar, who was the guy who was the night watchman of your compound that your house was in, completely walled.
Were you spoiled?
Yes, absolutely spoiled. Yes.
So another formative experience.
Yes. I mean, someone always made your bed and cleaned the whole house. And really, the whole house had to be swept pretty much daily. And there was a guy whose title was sweeper. He was the lowest caste person.
Really?
Of the group of servants. And he just moved around kind of squatting on the ground in this crab-like fashion with a broom that was just sort of the bristle part through the entire house, sweeping it every single day.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Did you dress yourself?
Barely, yes. But there are a lot of things that were crazy from that period, which every so often pop into my mind, like the fact that you couldn't drink the water out of the tap. So we never drank any water that hadn't been boiled first. And even brushing your teeth, you did from a jug of pre-boiled water that sat in your bathroom.
Wow.
It was an enormous house. It had, I think, five or six bedrooms, and each bedroom had its own separate bathroom. And
gosh.
But the laundry was done by a guy who came every week and did the laundry by putting it into the guest room's bathtub with detergent and stomping on it with his feet. And then rinsing it in this giant wringer machine from Sears, which my dad had brought along and had to be plugged in using a transformer.
Well, part of that is how I washed clothes when I was a bachelor.
Well, I'm sure it was kind of like that.
Stop around, get a bar of soap.
Except theoretically, not as many, in your laundry bachelordom, probably not as many tiny little socks that belong to an infant.
No, I had no infant socks.
Right.
Wow. Gosh, and then you lived in South Africa?
Right, and I was worried from coming from Karachi about what it would be like to live in Africa. I thought we were going to, of course, be eaten by lions. And of course, South Africa was that weird blend of first world in the apartheid era, first world, white world.
Right.
And then kind of second world, the black world.
Right.
It was pretty wild. I mean, to be a 10 or 11-year-old American child in South Africa, in apartheid South Africa, and see how human beings were treating each other.
Huh. Well, I lived in the segregated South when I was a child in the 60s.
Oh,
in
gosh,
North Carolina, they had, you go to the Sears, there's the white water fountain and the colored water fountain,
right,
and different schools and all that stuff. So I saw that too. Then I was living on a military base, so we'd go back to the base and that was integrated. We felt so
crazy.
Superior.
Oh, right. Well, you were superior.
We were superior. So, and you came back to the States eventually.
Right. And so I was, at that point, I guess at the end of sixth grade, and we moved back to Indianapolis, which was the headquarters of Eli Lilly Pharmaceuticals. And my father then was working in the marketing division of the company, and he just didn't really like it. So after a couple of years there, or maybe two or three years, we ended up moving back to Minnesota. My parents were Minnesotans.
So were you born here?
No, I was born in Estherville, Iowa.
Wow. Gosh.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a bit of a trip. And a lot of different schools.
Huh.
Well, none of which had anything to do with music.
but how did you get into music then? I think that's where I started this.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I'm thinking about Pakistan, and we had this beleaguered music teacher who serviced the entire school, and all I remember that we ever sang was the Pakistan national anthem and Goober Peas. Kind of not much of a repertoire, but I sang both very lustily.
Those are two different songs.
Well, yeah, in theory.
Okay.
But yeah, I can still kind of churn out the Pakistan national anthem, I've amazed some Pakistanis with that.
Can you give me a sense of the tune?
Sure. Aksar zameen shahad bad, Kishware haseen shahad bad.
That's probably never been on the air here at WCCO.
Probably not.
Gosh.
I did sing the entire thing with Dan Chouinard once when he used to have a show, again, back in the 80s,
right.
The singer's voice that he did out of the Dakota.
Wow.
When the Dakota was in Energy Park. But we talked about all kinds of musical things. And then he brought along a bunch of music that I'd mentioned, including Pakistani National Anthem.
Well, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And you've never been back, I bet.
No, but gosh, would I like to. Every so often I meet someone from Pakistan who still lives in Karachi or has family in Karachi, and they say, oh, you should come back and visit. I would be a little bit concerned about doing that at this point in our nation's history.
Right.
But someday I would love to get back there. It was an incredible experience. I mean, just to see that, to put it... mildly and obviously, people live very differently in different parts of the world than we do here in the United States.
Right.
And to spend your second and third and fourth grade in a place where construction is being done by human hands and donkeys carrying dirt and bricks on their backs. That's not even that long ago, and a lot of construction is still done.
What I enjoyed in my upbringing, being on military bases, is that the kids and the parents, of course, were from every state in the union. You know, mm-hmm. you got a lot of different perspectives, and I felt that too traveling around the U.S., living in different places, and living in different countries. The perspectives are even greater.
Yes,
but I dare say most people growing up in Minnesota don't quite have that advantage of seeing different viewpoints.
Well, no, and. When we were getting ready to go into war with Iraq, and all the people in the State Department who'd spent time in the Middle East were running around with their hair on fire,
right.
saying, what you want to do cannot be done, it was interesting to me that the people who'd never been there were the ones who were so eager to perpetrate a war that ended pretty, or continues,
right.
pretty much as everyone in the State Department predicted it would, and that even I... who was there as a 10-year-old could have predicted it would, because many people are living still fairly primitively by our standards,
mm-hmm.
But also have a history that has nothing in common with most Americans' worldview, and that doesn't just turn around because you depose a single leader.
Right, and then I also dare say that. Most of the people that jumped on the war bandwagon could not find it on a map.
I'm sorry to say, I think you're quite right.
Wow. So, let's see. We've been talking now for 12 minutes. We haven't gotten to how you became a singer.
Well, okay. So I was always kind of singing a little bit at home, but really never around the house exactly. I used to sing in bed at night.
Really?
Uh-huh. I'd sing all the Christmas carols I knew, especially those in the minor mode, which I preferred. I like things that sounded sad, even though I was always a very cheerful person.
Hmm.
And so then eventually when I had a chance to sing in a choir, that was quite a thrill. And meanwhile, I was taking piano lessons. In fact, every time I even mentioned taking piano lessons, my palms began to sweat because I did not like playing the piano in front of anyone. And I really was never a very good pianist. I would always be told how musical I was, but I just never really had... I think the kind of eye-hand coordination that is one of the many requirements to be a really good or even a competent pianist.
So you didn't play piano in bed?
Certainly not, yes, because the bed was far removed from the piano, although I might have noodled around had it been closer. So I was taking piano lessons and learning how to read music. And then when I finally had the chance in school, and basically the first real chance was in high school to sing in a choir, I was just thrilled by that. And for a long time, I imagined that if there were any kind of job I could ever have in music, I assumed it would be having to do with a choir, being a choral conductor.
Did people say, what a beautiful voice you have, Maria?
Well, once I was doing a little bit of singing in choirs, then I did hear that occasionally. But there wasn't really that much solo opportunity for most of the time that I was in high school.
All those other singers.
That's right. And all those extremely responsible choral conductors who kept people in the team, which I think is a great way to, thing about a choir.
There's no I in team.
That's right.
And so when did you break out and become an individual?
Well, I think in college, I went off to Hamline with the thought that I would be a choral conductor, and I quickly dropped that idea when I realized that I also didn't have, I mean, the same deficits that made me not a competent pianist looked like they would help me fail as a choral conductor. And also, I didn't want to practice it. There was that. But I still loved singing, and I loved words. And so one semester when my regular professor, Reese Allison, was on sabbatical, my piano professor, and a new guy came in to take his place for that semester who was really kind of a hard ass, I thought, well, I just really didn't like it anymore. And I didn't want to work the way which was probably a very appropriate way to want to work on the piano. And so I thought I'd take voice lessons instead, kind of as a lark. And I thought, oh, this is about a billion times easier. One note at a time. And words, and I loved words.
One note at a time.
Right, as opposed to
piano one, doing chords.
Yeah, like 10 opportunities for error, I always thought of piano as that. So you can only make one mistake at a time as a singer, at least on a note.
Gosh, so you're kind of a minimalist.
A little bit, but I also really like the word part, the words part, which is why I was kind of interested in that. And then realized that it's fun to sing by yourself, and it's fun to be in charge of your own musical decisions.
Hmm.
And if you're a choral singer, you aren't really so much in charge of that. You're part of the group, and you've got the dictator in the front, the benevolent, hopefully benevolent dictator, is in charge of how the music's going.
Well, they usually have a stick.
That's true, and a sharp stick.
Sharp stick. And so was it at Hamline that you had a recital then or something?
Yeah, I decided to be a voice major, and so then I was getting a little bit of solo stuff in among the choral pieces because there was more choral music with solo opportunities then, and I was hanging out in the music library illicitly under cover of darkness when it was closed.
Really?
There was a really sweet custodian who, in fact, I think he had been, he was some kind of upper echelon military person from Vietnam.
Oh, I
remember that was the big influx of immigrants from Vietnam.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say it was a Pakistani.
No, that would have been good too, because I guess I could have sung the national anthem to him. That would have been impressive. But at that point, there was the huge influx of Laotian, Cambodian immigrants.
Sure.
And eventually Hmong, but also, while I was at Hamline, Persians.
Really?
These are the refugees from Iran,
right?
When the Shah had been deposed and the revolution had come, and a lot of fairly well-off young Persian,
right,
in quotes, men showed up on the Hamline campus.
This is circa 1980.
Right, and just before.
Mm-hmm. And before, yeah. I remember I was downtown Minneapolis, and there was a store there, kind of where the basketball stadium is now, Target Stadium. And it was Iran Imports.
Oh, wow.
And the owner or proprietor was painting over the sign, changing it to Persian Imports.
Wow, right.
Nobody knows they're the same country.
Right, it just sounds differently romantic than a place where there's just been an uncomfortable revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was the era when I was at Hamline. And I loved the choir and I loved singing in it as a team member and the little solo bits that I got. And then gradually I was working on being a solo singer and spending a lot of time by myself in the music library between probably 10:30 and, p.m. and 1 a.m., my favorite time to be sucking in information. So I was going through all these scores of the operas of Handel and thinking, wow, that music is really cool.
Mm.
And really developing an interest in early music, old music, so music from the Baroque era and before.
Now, did you sit in the stacks and sing along, or is that...
No, so mostly...
People go, shh.
Well, no, because I was the only one in there because it was locked. That's why I had to have my ally.
Oh, okay.
The former general from Vietnam.
Wow.
Who would let me in there every night.
Gosh. Mm-hmm. But you didn't sing. You just kind of read.
Yeah, mostly reading, and I kind of like hum a little bit, I guess. But I was mostly just kind of sucking in the musical information, I guess.
Wow. We're talking with Maria Jetti, the famous soprano, especially in these parts. And she's our guest today here on Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau, and we'll be back right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back talking with Maria Jetti. She's our solo guest today, which is very apropos because she's a soloist for much of her career. And finally figured out how she learned how to sing or discover herself as a singer was at Hamline University back in the early 80s, I guess.
Extremely early, or some might call them the late 70s.
Late 70s, yeah. Well, for a lot of us, that kind of merges all together. It's
that's
like
right.
a big fog.
Yeah, that's right. Like so, the 60s encompass about 20 years, it seems like.
But it's all parents want their kids to go into the arts because that's where the money is.
Do they? Right. Gosh. Yeah, in fact, I was recently recalling how my dad, he died really before my career had it become something that I could actually live on in kind of a middle class sort of way. But he apparently used to imagine that I would become an attorney.
Really?
So he only was able to be disappointed before. Wow. I was actually making more of a living as a singer. It's a pity.
I think on the career map, singer and attorney are on opposite sides of the country.
In a way, although I suppose I could have been one of those performance style prosecutors.
What's
in the
that?
Courtroom. I mean, you know, those showboaty attorneys. Could have done that.
The singing attorney.
Right. They have to be careful with their voices, some of those courtroom types.
I'm trying to think of a song that has guilty in it a lot.
Oh, gosh. Well, give me a couple hours and I'll find one.
I'm sure you can. In the library there.
Yes,
locked
right.
In the library.
Yes, I'm still a library hound to this very day.
Wow. And then, so how did you launch your career?
Well, when I got out of Hamline, and I mean got out, not graduate.
You didn't
because
graduate?
Because I didn't properly graduate from Hamline. I was just a horrible student in many respects. What I loved doing was practicing. So I'd go into the practice room for all hours. I mean, when I wasn't in the library, music library, I'd be just singing away in the practice rooms. But I was just terrible about getting my work done. And I got most of it done, but I never really got going on that was, I suppose, the crowning achievement of a person's college career, some kind of independent study that was a requirement. And I just resented it in the most stupid and naive way. Somehow I felt that it was wrong that I would pay to come up with my own idea and go through with it. It just didn't occur to me at the time that I had all these these really intelligent, experienced professors there who would help me with it.
Hmm. So
I just didn't do it.
You never graduated?
Well, I didn't graduate then. And okay. I have a, well, we thought it was a hilarious picture, my roommate and I, looking with astonishment at our empty diplomas. We did go through graduation, but with empty diplomas.
Really?
And then
with no tassel.
Well, no, we had tassels. I think we had tassels.
Really?
And we went through the whole thing, but we didn't have to be humiliated by, well, I don't know if you probably wouldn't be humiliated if you didn't just go up and if you failed to go up and get a diploma. But anyway,
no,
years
went
by. You
feel hypocritical is what you
I guess so, but I don't know. Anyway, that was a,
wow.
It was kind of a defy authority thing. And no one was damaged by it except possibly me.
Wow.
Exactly. So years later, 13 years later, I had a call from the registrar at Hamline asking about my Social Security number. And I said, oh, gosh, do I still owe money? Because I was convinced I'd paid everything
because
off.
Of those library books you never returned.
Right. Well, they oddly enough, they never even knew about that. Those are the ones I never took out. Officially.
Oh, okay.
But we'll let that pass. I asked her what it was all about, and she said, well, we need to send you your diploma, and we're just doing it. I said, diploma? But I haven't finished my requirements for the degree. And she said, well, no, Reese Allison sent in your grade for your final class.
Wow.
Said he was sick of looking at the incomplete.
So you were a graduate.
Well, I think it was a matter of life experience at that point.
Hmm.
And And, you know, it's nice for a little tiny school that in my year graduated, and I'm putting that in quotation marks since I didn't technically graduate, but in the year when I supposedly graduated, I think there were just six of us.
Wow.
Out of the music program. So I think it's good to be able to claim you've got a graduate who's actually doing something in the field that they
claimed you.
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's good. So, you got credit for being a professional singer.
I'd been degree free for all those years, and now I can't brag about that anymore. But the one thing that it did do was, I mean, not having a degree, it prevented me from looking into graduate schools because I knew I had to have that degree first. So I just, you know, I'd looked at a couple of programs, and in those days, the Eastman School of Music was just starting up or New England Conservatory, starting up early music programs. So that's music from the Baroque era on back, Renaissance, medieval music. And I would have loved to have done that. But without that degree, I couldn't. And then I just couldn't get myself to deal with it. And time moved on, and I had a few jobs in the restaurant business, and had started to do some singing with the Minnesota Chorale for 1 year as an unpaid chorister, and then I got a job as a paid section leader, and that was in the very infancy of the Twin Cities paying anything for choral section leaders. Dale Warland was just really getting going in a big way at that time. Philip Brunel was I guess at that point he would have been probably in his 10th year of Plymouth Music Series, but there weren't that many paid singer possibilities in the Twin Cities or in the United States at that time. Unlike now, where it's really kind of a viable middle-class income possibility to work as a choral singer, professional choral singer in the United States.
So you did it out of love and lucked out.
Well, I wouldn't say, yeah, I guess kind of out of love, but I thought it would be great to be able to make a living as a musician. I just wasn't quite sure how. So that was my first real sort of paid regular thing, and I was just recalling with a friend the other day, $10 per rehearsal, $25 per performance. That's how much the section leaders got.
Live it up.
And I think there were maybe 16 section leaders in the Minnesota Chorale. But from there, I started to get some solo work. My first big solo thing was with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and it was kind of a last-minute-ish thing, and Joel Revson at that time was the conductor of Minnesota Chorale and was an affiliate of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and they needed someone to sing this excruciatingly difficult piece by a British composer, Oliver Nussen, and it had a bunch of really high notes in it, and in those days, I had some super high notes, long lost at this point. But I was, you know, I was a kind of a bright bulb and interested in working hard and had those high notes. And so he recommended me and I got the job and acquitted myself, you know, decently and competently. And that was sort of the beginning for me of some other work with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra and then spread out in other ways.
Well, good for you. And I know you got famous a lot for being on Prairie Home Companion. Is that right? How did that happen?
Well, let's see, that was quite some time later. I first sang on Garrison's show, actually, in my Hamlin days. I had a barbershop quartet in Hamlin called the Quarter Tones. And we just, because I loved barbershop music, and I'd actually had a quartet in high school, too. Why can't I remember the name of our quartet? Shoot. But anyway, we had a repertoire of about three numbers, I think, in high school. But then the quartet in college, we had a kind of a nice little program of barbershop numbers. And then we went out to the Renaissance Festival and we sang there too, in these really highly suspect rearrangements of material that was for mixed choirs. So we would sing out there in long kind of phony Renaissance looking dresses and try to fend off the drunken bikers brandishing their charred turkey legs, trying to to grab the wenches.
The Renaissance riffraff.
Yes, or the Renaissance.
Renaissance.
As some people seem to like to. But anyway, what was the point of that?
Well, I was talking about Garrison Keillor.
Oh, yes, right. So during my high school years, we had that little quartet. We had sung out at our annual choir gathering at the Emporium of Jazz, which used to be out in Eagan. Or Mendota. It was in Mendota. And I think it was Charlie DeVore, the cornet player, who mentioned us to Garrison Keillor, who was just at that point, he had a show which was not broadcast outside of the outside of Minnesota Public Radio at that time. It was just local. And so we got a chance to go sing on his program. I remember I was scared out of my mind.
Was that still his morning show?
No, this was when he'd started doing the evening show, which I think was, I think he started that actually in something like 1974 or five.
I think the mid-70s. Mm-hmm.
So we were on his show then with the very young Harrison before his voice got even lower and more radio-y. And that was my first time.
Was
and
he then, wearing a white suit?
I don't think so.
He had a white suit era.
Yeah, I think, and that is the kind of the more recent era. But he was just kind of a young, getting stuff going kind of guy in those days. So then the years went by, and I would hear him on the radio sometimes. I mean, in the morning show, which I loved. And I guess it was in the middle '80s when I would occasionally be on as part of someone's choral group. You know, part of a group. And then I got started working with Philip Brunel and that gang. And I was on a couple of times with a very small group or as a soloist with a little group of singers that Philip had put together. And then finally was on as my own self, just by myself. I think it must have been something like 95 or 96.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Just like yesterday.
Well, yeah. Well, what's 25 years? But once I was on as myself, then it was usually, you know, a couple times a year, I guess.
Mm. Was that fun?
Yeah, really fun. You've got to be the kind of person who enjoys a bit of a high wire existence, because it was on that show, you could prepare like crazy, but you never knew what might change at the last minute.
What, in terms of the song or what?
Well, often you'd have several songs prepared, and then the which song would be chosen would be picked kind of at the last minute, or you might have to make a cut in it shortly before doing it. Or my favorite story, and this was, I think it was maybe the first or second time I was on the show as myself, where I really came to appreciate the freaky genius of Garrison as a writer as well as performer. I was in a skit. It was just myself and Garrison, or Garrison and me, I should say. And it was about a guy calling in to a catalog company to order something and falling in love with the voice of the operator. So we went through it once on Friday, and I went home with my script and I highlighted my part and I did all these different line readings at home. And then I came in the next day and they said, "Oh, Maria, here's the revised script for that thing." And I thought, I looked at it, it was completely different. So I had to get rid of the one that I'd worked on and highlight the new one. And then we ran through it and it had totally been changed in an adorable way that kind of reflected me more than the imaginary other person. And then when we were getting ready to do it, I was sitting in the wings, and someone was playing some kind of guitar solo. And Garrison came over and said, "The show's running a little long, so I think on our sketch, I'll be making a few cuts. We should probably read off the same script." I thought, well, okay. So then there went my score with the highlighting. So I put that down. So as we stood there performing it, he was looking ahead with a Sharpie and just making cuts while we were doing it. That talk about nerveless, mm-hmm. but also, I mean, what a mind. Mm-hmm. Because as you would know, as a person who's a writer and an editor, writing is one thing, editing is a whole different thing. And to be able to just edit yourself in the kind of cold-blooded, efficient and perfect way, that's a pretty rare sort of talent.
Plus, with the clock ticking,
and live, in the living rooms of 4 million people.
Well, that's the fun part of doing live. That kind of
exactly.
Adrenaline.
Yes,
and
it's
you enjoyed
really
that. You can do that.
I did. Not everyone likes that for good reason, because it is dangerous.
Dangerous and fun.
Yes.
Because I know you have a great sense of humor. Did you ever think about getting into acting? Have you been in any plays?
No, I mean, I've been, I've done, I've done, you know, musicals. Or I'm even thinking of musical theater, not really, but opera things that I've been in operas, Mozart operas, a lot of Baroque operas, and things where there were opportunities for comedy. I had a little show that I done about a billion times around the country, a two-person little mini opera version of Green Eggs and Ham, and then another Dr. Seuss thing, Gertrude McFuzz, I've done with orchestras and small sort of pit bands and even with just piano for probably a couple hundred thousand kids all together.
Wow.
And that's funny in comedy, and that I've really liked doing. But I as a lazy person, I hate memorizing things. And the thought, I just look at my friends who are actors and they're going, oh, I've got an audition, I've got to go memorize this monologue. And I keep thinking, God, I would just as soon shoot myself as memorize a monologue and then go have to do it for someone and not even get the job. So anyway, I guess the overarching issue is too lazy to memorize a bunch of stuff. But also, I mean, I like to see other people in plays. But I've never been that interested in being in plays. And again, that might be part of my being only partly a team player. I like to be in charge of my own stuff. So
all those other actors.
Well, and directors. I mean, there are a lot of great directors, and I've been directed by some great people. But I've also been directed a couple times by people who I thought were absolute nincompoops. And then you're blamed for their stupid ideas, especially if you go along with them. So having been burned by trying to be a team player and do exactly what I was told to do, to my own detriment, I just don't want to do that.
Well, I never knew you were so fussy.
I am very fussy. I just don't want to. If I'm going to look like a fool on stage, I want it to be my own decision and not something I'm doing at someone else's behest.
Well, you once told me it was so tense singing sometimes because if you're doing something that's been recorded, people know it.
Yes.
They can tell if you're off a little bit.
Well, or if you're not doing it how they think it should be done. And again, that's like there are a whole bunch of quotation marks in there. Because I think that was one of the things that I always thought was so uninteresting about standard opera repertoire. And of course, I've sung a lot of these great arias, which are just wonderful pieces of music, and have done them by themselves with, you know, orchestras or in, you know, luncheons for opera societies or whatever they were. And it's wonderful to sing, you know, Carmen's big arias or Violetta's arias. But every time you do, you're stepping into a very long line of other singers who've sung them before. And the tyranny of some great recordings and the fact that people may have listened to Renata Tebaldi sing that piece 20,000 times.
Talk about a tyrant.
Exactly. These unwitting tyrants, I'll put it that way.
Gosh.
So if someone has done one of those famous arias a certain way, well, and I guess maybe more recently might be someone like Renee Fleming, who was so emulated by so many sopranos for, you know, a 30 years worth of her career, where everyone wanted to sound like that. And I have always thought that it seems like a waste of raw material to decide you only want to sound like someone else.
Hmm.
Or to just take the musical decisions of someone else and decide not to have any of your own, but to only do something the way others have done it. Hmm. I mean, it's also great to have a performing tradition. I don't object to that, but I do object to the thought that just because I choose to look at the score and interpret it a certain way, that must be a wrong way, because of a favorite recording that someone has listened to and they decide that's the right way.
It reminds me of one of my traumatic formative experiences in kindergarten. And they said, don't color outside the lines.
Oh.
So you wanted to talk about authority.
Yes, that's right.
We're talking here with the anarchistic and individualistic and very fussy Maria Jetty.
You forgot nitpicky.
Nitpicky, that's right. Uh-huh. And see, there you go. You're exemplifying what
right.
You're saying. I'm Steve LeBeau. We'll be back with Synapse Think Tank of the Air right after this.
Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back with Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau with Maria Jetty, the soprano, extraordinaire.
Or a vocalist.
See? And very fussy. Very fussy. We're learning all about that. You know, one of the things that's bothered me for a long time, you know, I've always been kind of a jazz enthusiast. Uh-huh. And then I would read about these classical musicians. And Mozart and Beethoven, when they were at home tinkling the ivories, mm-hmm. they would improvise. But once they set it down on paper and hand it over to a tyrannical director, it never changes. The notes are just there. They're like frozen.
Well, yes and no.
And so have you ever felt like just riffing off of an opera, you know, like jazzing it up?
Well, actually, there are lots of opportunities to do that really officially, and especially in the operas of the Baroque era and into the operas of Mozart. There are always places left for a cadenza or opportunities galore to ornament the music that's there, and that was really an expected, something that you'd be expected to be able to do.
So it's the classical version of just take it.
Yeah, exactly. So and you can kind of always hear it coming up when the orchestra, even for something like a piano concerto, same kind of thing, the piano's going doodly 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 doodly, and then the orchestra goes bum bum ba, and then there's sort of this breath, and then the piano go bum like something all by themselves.
They take it.
That theoretically they're making it up, but I mean a lot of people kind of write out part of it or
right,
and we. We, that sounds so academic, and there exist plenty of written out, written down records of what people
have done. Here's a great improv, memorize this.
Yes, exactly. Although by memorizing someone else's improv and making it come out of yourself, then you get an idea of how that person worked it out. Just like you do in, you know, singing a great opera song, an aria from an opera, you kind of get an idea of how that composer worked, and you know you've stepped into with the really famous pieces, you've stepped into a long line of people who've probably had similar issues with, you know, difficulties in particular spots that you're having yourself. But yeah, there's a lot of opportunity for moving around kind of flexibility, even in written down music. Because if you think about how a robot might sing a song of Schubert, for example, even if they're singing the correct syllables for the correct duration of time on the correct pitches, it's very different from a human mouth and a human brain operating on that text, that poetry, and the kind of little micro changes that you do in terms of rhythm and even though it's still within the general framework that the composer has laid out. Hmm. Sometimes you're not aware of it until you hear someone who's really bad at it. I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. You can hear someone who just sounds really clunky singing a famous piece, and then you hear, you know, like, for example, in songs of Franz Schubert, very famous German song composer, you might hear a famous singer like Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau do it, and you think, oh, wow, that's an elegant piece of music, or that's funny, or gosh, that's super sad. And then you hear a student or just a kind of a lame professional sing it, and you think, God, that is really a boring piece. Hmm. So there's a lot of micro improvisation that goes on in the context of written down.
Well, the artistry of interpretation.
That's it in a nutshell.
The you know, getting back, like I say, I'm more familiar with the jazz realm.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm fussy, when I'm feeling jettish, one thing that bothers me is there might be some old recordings or, you know, like a big band or old jazz things. And then you hear somebody doing it in a new version. And the new versions, it's like they're technically perfect.
Oh.
Like you can tell they went to graduate school uh-huh. in whatever instrument they're in. And but it seems to be missing the soul. Mm. You know, it's like sometimes the old recordings, they may not have always been perfect, but it swung better. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, talking about robotic, I think that's the error of being too perfect.
Right. Although I always think that it's kind of dangerous to say this is soulful and this isn't, because you can never know the inner person. But also people have different takes on what constitutes soulfulness.
Vibrato.
Vibrato, right? Or is like in the opera world, there's a lot of kind of scooping and sliding that I always found distasteful which is another reason why I was never that interested in standard opera. And yet for a lot of people, that's part of what makes something sound soulful. If someone's, instead of like going from note to note really cleanly, someone's kind of like swooping up to it or like sliding down to a note. And there are really elegant ways that people can do that. But I think there are a lot of people for whom that is a big part of what they consider to be soulful singing. And someone who's not doing that, therefore, is singing without soul. And it's impossible to say what a person is really thinking or feeling, well, at any time, I guess, in human life, but in music almost more especially. Just like it within acting. I mean, you can look at a person whose muscles on their face are giving you every indication that they are just dying inside. But inside, they might not be dying inside. Inside, they're thinking, I think I should move my eyebrow micrometer to the north a little bit. Yes, that's it. Now I really look sad.
Well, it shouldn't be so strange to have artifice in art.
Yes, right. Exactly. Because the whole point is to evoke the emotions in others.
Mm-hmm.
And more that than, in theory, than to feel them yourself. And often you can't really evoke them as well in others if you are feeling it yourself. I mean, if you decide that you're going to remember that time that your dog was hit by a car in front of your very eyes in order to look really sad.
Well, that's how they would make child actresses cry.
That's right.
And you know, we just kidnapped your dog.
Right. These horrible ideas. And it does work, but you can't sing a big fancy piece of vocal music if you're truly sad.
Uncomposed.
You've got to figure out a way to put it across without having it affect all the complex musculature inside.
Well, another angle on this sense of what is art. Think of a lot of artists thinking maybe of the visual arts. They might paint for themselves and don't care whether anyone likes it or not. But as a performer with an audience, they kind of have to like it.
Kind of. Well, or at least have paid in advance.
Do you get a bigger kick out of singing to an audience, or could you just be just as happy singing in a soundproof booth?
Oh, those are really totally different things. I mean, I think that, you know, one reason to be a singer is just the kind of sensual experience of it that can be very pleasurable.
Expression.
If everything's working well. Expression, but also just how it feels coming out of your body. I think that's one reason why a lot of people love singing the big romantic opera repertoire.
I thought you were going to say in the shower.
and singing that repertoire in the shower too, where you've got a really nice acoustic. But it just feels good sometimes, like to sing a really, you know, sing really loudly, or and especially these people, if you think of someone like a, you know, Pavarotti or Domingo, those are voices that people know, these big ringing golden tenor voices. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of what people like is not just the sound as they hear it, but that you perceive the joy that the person has in having that come out of their body. I mean, there's a kind of a sensual pleasure in that you can see. And
I was going to say primal.
Yeah, it is primal. Well, it's basically controlled screaming, singing, you know,
wow,
in a sense.
And so what's your answer? Do you just enjoy getting that out and feeling it personally, or do you like to amuse people?
Oh, I love to amuse people, or to interest them, or make them sad. I like to make people very sad.
Mm.
Well, not really, but I will say that I guess I'm in a way kind of like a musical archaeologist, in that I love digging up old music that doesn't have a chance. You know, we like with books, people read a lot of the same books, and we've got our canon of great literature, and people read them over and over and love them because they're great. But there's a lot of other excellent literature that deserves to be read or could be read and enjoyed. And certainly with music, my gosh, there's just, we hear the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg of music that's been written.
Well,
only.
I've
and there's
been
so
to,
much more to hear.
See, I've been to, it's like in these different genres, You go to the opera and it's always Madame Butterfly.
Right. Or Carmen.
If you go to a dance, it's always Swan Lake.
Right. Right.
Know? So yeah, you're right. You know, there's got to be other things.
Well, and of course, those are the big sellers. So they've got to keep putting those on to get the money so they can perform the more avant-garde things or just the less commonly performed things. You know, there's some certain names in opera that people will come to. They'll come to Verdi, they'll come to Rossini, they'll come to Mozart. But those have to, you know, they have to be sort of like the Sound of Music of opera in order to bring in the big bucks so that then like Minnesota Opera can commission.
To bring in the do-re-mi.
Precisely. But I love digging up, you know, poor orphan music that needs its chance, or that you think, gosh, people would love this if they only had a chance to hear it. And mostly they do. So I just want everyone to like the things I like. There, I said it. I want to persuade them to like the things I like, because there's so many things to like.
Well, it's good that there's someone out there discovering these things, because what bothers me is there's so much out there. Mm-hmm. Like for contemporary music, I don't even try.
Right.
For any genre, it's like, you know, for pop, I'll have my daughter, okay, send me your 30 favorites so I don't have to wade through all this stuff that I know I'm not going to like. And I know there's some good stuff out there, but please filter it for me. And, you know, I think for a lot of classical music as well as a lot of classical books, you wait till the person's dead. And then you see what history has done. And if they survived and people are still listening to it, you know, then, hey, okay, that's a viable option, although not viable for the creator.
Right. Well, you know, the sad thing is, of course, there's so much music that just has never been recorded, just sitting there in a library somewhere. The notes, all the instructions are there on a piece of paper. All the nice little black specks that tell you what pitch to sing when, for how long, what words to sing with it. It's just sitting there quietly, waiting for its chance.
So what's the range of things that you love? I mean, I know you talked about opera, and I know there's a certain genre of classical songs.
Yeah, and I'm really not much of an opera singer. I never really was. But I've sung quite a bit of it, and especially Baroque opera I really like.
Okay.
But then oratorio, that's another angle that a working singer will get into, and that's, excuse me, basically kind of like operas except with religious topics or that are not designed to be acted out. So something like Handel's Messiah or the big pieces by Bach, the Bach B minor Mass or the St. Matthew Passion or Mozart's Requiem or the great Mass in C minor of Mozart or Elijah by Mendelssohn. So I've sung a lot of that repertoire, which is really fun and thrilling to sing with, you know, orchestras of small or giant size. And other kinds of music that's written for a singer with orchestra, music of Mahler, for example. I've sung the Mahler Fourth Symphony a lot. And that's just got the greatest last movement. That's soprano singing the child's view of heaven. And it's just sweet and funny and pleasurable to sing, and people like it. And it is nice to sing music that people like. I will say that I have sung music that people haven't liked. And it hasn't always been my fault. I mean, where I've been hired to sing unpleasant music.
Some tyrant or other.
Yes, or some horrible modern piece that probably will never be performed again. And there's so much great music being written. It just seems sad that we would ever perform music that no one likes. But, you know, the compliment that you always get after something like that is someone saying, especially in Minnesota, they'll say, "Wow, that was real different." And of course, your fellow singers are saying, "Better you than me."
So, now I'm sure you didn't have that kind of repertoire for your barbershop quartet.
No, definitely not. We were singing things like "Peg of My Heart," for example, and "Am I Blue."
But how far do you step into pop music?
Almost all the way, but depending on the era. So at this point, I'm doing not very much at all with orchestras. At my advanced age as a gray eminence. Because that is kind of a young person's game, especially for sopranos. Not so much for basses, who can go on doing it until they're 70 years old. But I do a lot of chamber music still. That's, you know, music with much smaller forces. I do a lot of music is just song with piano, and that includes classical song. Lately, I've been doing a lot of French song from the sort of the late 1880s up through the 1950s, that era in there, which I adore, which j'adore, I should say. But German art song, which I love too. I mean, British art song. So these are music written by, you know, quote unquote, again, with the quotes, serious song composers, Vaughan Williams or Benjamin Britten.
So you don't get into Cole Porter or Gershwin?
Yes, I also do.
You do?
And I've done quite a bit of music from the late 19-teens into the early 20s with lyrics by P.G. Woodhouse. This is my pet project.
Right. Well, that's you're fascinated with all of his writings.
Yes, I am. And it turns out that Woodhouse was one of the sort of progenitors of the modern American music theater in the early days of the 20s or of the 20th century, along with Jerome Kern. Most people have heard of him. The guy wrote Showboat.
Jerry
Kern and a fellow named Guy Bolton. They.
I thought it was Guy.
It could have been Guy, except he was a Brit.
Oh.
So they wrote several musicals for a theater called the Princess Theater on Broadway in those days, which is a smaller theater. It had a tiny little pit that would only seat, I think, 11 players at most, and a very small stage. They couldn't fit too huge of a production on it. And so they ended up doing shows that were smaller shows, you know, as opposed to these big operetta-type shows with 40 dancing girls and a million set changes and, you know, the Duchess of Gerolstein or something who needed a lot of fancy outfits. They could do more vernacular subjects of, you know, a shop girl in Manhattan and her boyfriend, the elevator boy, something like that, with a bunch of shop girls as the chorus. So it was cheaper for costuming, cheaper for an orchestra because you just couldn't even fit very many in there. And they packed this little theater that seated 299 people and had these long runs. And then suddenly everyone realized that they could be doing these smaller forces of musicals, which were cheaper to put on and which people loved and that fit very well with the sort of comedic ideas of the era. And that's how modern Broadway was born, in a way. I mean, from that perspective. So I've done a lot of that material with Dan Chouinard. We've got a couple of CDs of that music, which is just super delicious, fun, and charming music. And in fact, in about a month, a little over a month, oh my gosh, we'll be going off to the Woodhouse Society's biennial convention.
Where is that?
This year it's in Cincinnati.
Okay.
So we've done several of these, and we'll be doing some kind of a program involving Woodhouse's material and maybe probably some other songs that have been mentioned in the works of Woodhouse, of which there are many. Mm. Woodhouse is a lifelong consumer of popular music of his day.
Well, now probably the most widely heard thing you've done is on this commercial that's on TV, right?
Yes.
Are you allowed to talk about that?
Perhaps not.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Not.
Yes, not.
Okay. I'll leave that for you to edit.
Okay. Well, geez, we're just about out of time anyway, so I guess you can escape from that. Pardon me?
Oh, I was just going to ask if you were ever going to ask me about French prison camp.
Well, we that might be a whole nother program, but
right.
We are out of time, and I know you have to run to the library before.
Yes,
so
I
you
do.
Can be locked in all night.
Exactly.
So it's been so fun. I'm talking about all these things. We've never had a chance to sit and talk just about your whole career and your servants in Pakistan. Talking here with Maria Jetty. So keep it an eye on the arts and entertainment schedule because your name pops up all the time.
I'm here and there, often at Crooners these days.
Often at Crooners. Mm-hmm. Where is that?
That's on Central, just north of 694, and all kinds of music happens there.
Okay.
Jazz music by all kinds of different people, and occasionally classical music, and everything in between.
Okay. Well, I can't wait to hear the in between part. Okay, thank you, Maria Jetty. This is Steve LeBeau signing off for this week's edition of Synapse Think Tank of the Air. I'd like to thank Dan Culhane, our producer, and also I'd like to mention that this is a co-production, if I can mention it at all, with WCCO Radio. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.